your life. Ordinary things, simple things, every day of your life. We are hearing Moses preach. This is the closest you get to go. So you imagine like a great big national conference and there's a headline speaker. This is the prophet Moses. He's the preacher. He's the one that's speaking. And as he preaches, you get to hear God. God speaks, not just, you know, sometimes I think when some speakers speak, you hear a bit of them, you hear something of the Lord. It's an admixture of the two. When you hear Moses, you hear the word of the Lord. And it might appear as we look at these sort of things, they might say, you know, what is the Lord saying to us? What's this preacher talking about? Why is this important for us to hear? But I want to remind you that this second sermon begins with the Ten Commandments, doesn't it? He starts with reminding them of the Ten Commandments. And not just as a reminder, he begins to preach the commandments. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. He's preaching these things to them to establish these things firmly in their lives and in the life of their community. And he's showing them not just what the commandments are, but how they apply, how these things work their way out into the nitty-gritty and the details of everyday life. Now, at the beginning of the sermon, you've got these huge building blocks, 10 commandments. And then afterwards, you have some sections on, let's say, justice and the importance of justice. And now here we're getting down into these little details. Various laws, a comment on this, a little bit on that. And I think it can be likened to a building. When you build a building, you have these great big breeze blocks, don't you? And then outside it, you have a layer of smaller bricks on the outside, and then there's the plaster and the rendering and then the details. So as we go through this sermon, we've had the big stuff has been established. This is the structure of the sermon. The big stuff has been established. And now he's kind of covering that up and he's getting down to the detail. He's showing these are little filials and details and cornices on this great construction that this sermon is. And it is interesting to see that, so in one sense, the structure of the sermon is breaking. Starts with these big, bold statements, and then it gets down to sort of somewhat more refined statements. And here we're getting to these various things, these small things. And you can feel the energy levels, if I can put it like that, of the preacher beginning to somewhat diminish. And ahead of him, he has his conclusion, and there is a thunderous conclusion to this sermon, which he is approaching. So I think this is the quiet before the storm, if I can put it like that. Here we have all these various laws, and he's been speaking about the importance of justice. You imagine that somebody having spoken about the law would then talk about the importance of justice, because that is how the law gets worked out in people's lives, isn't it? And now he's talking about these small, fine details. But everything, the point I'm making is everything derives from the Ten Commandments. These little details, these little things are linked to those first statements at the beginning. They're not detached. We've got to keep that in mind. And you'll see, just glance at it with me, and you'll see various laws there, those 12 verses. Then there's a section on sexual immorality and exclusion from the assembly. You'll see that there are, on the next page, miscellaneous laws. Can you see there's a number of these miscellaneous laws coming out up to chapter 25. Some are longer, some are shorter, until this conclusion begins in chapter 26. So what's going on? What's going on? In the Song of Solomon, there's a beautiful little verse in Song of Solomon. It says, "Catch the little foxes that spoil the vine." You know, sometimes it's only a little thing that can make a huge amount of difference, can't it? You only need a little blob of ketchup on a pristine wedding dress. It doesn't have to be much, but it can be. It can ruin something, can't it? It ruins something, it becomes ruinous. We're getting down into the little things, but the little things are important. The little things matter. We've had this list of just previous, in the previous chapters, about laws concerning warfare, about murder, about rape, about theft, about rebellion, And now we're talking about a bird's nest. It's like we're getting down to these little things, these little matters. You'd think almost that these were beneath the attention of the preacher. These were beneath the attention of God. That God only deals with the big things. But he's showing his care over the clothes people wear, whether they do this or do that in a little private matter, a little private moment. Why? Why? Because the little things are the thin end of the wedge, aren't they? It's the little things that begin this kind of insipid things that wear away at the very fabric and base of society. The little things that add up to a kind of culture or an atmosphere in a room, the attitudes of people's hearts. And we tell ourselves about the little things that the little things don't matter. It doesn't matter. Nobody will know. Nobody would care. We tell ourselves these things, don't we? And in that moment, we accept a lie. We accept a lie. And a passage like that rebukes us and tells us God cares about the little things. And the section conveys what can only be described as these rules concerning the civil life, how people live together, living together well. If people don't live together well, a kind of... When we think of corruption, you think of, you know, huge bribes and gangs, don't you? And all this sort of thing, bungs of money. This kind of low-level corruption at the very base of society, like a dry rot, like a dry rot. In the first few verses, verses 1 through to 4, there's the little sheep walking down the lane, and somebody just turns a blind eye. It's not mine. It's not my business. They turn a blind eye. And in that moment, something's happened. There's a transaction has taken place between that person and their God. God cares about how they respond in that moment. The verse 5 there, the person who starts to put on the clothing of a man putting on a woman's clothing, a woman putting on a man's clothing, in that quiet, private moment, wanting to be something they're not, to kind of from the heart, some aspiration to be something they're not. Refusing the call. God is calling them to be somebody. And they're trying to shake off that call. Verses 6 through to 7. There's the nest with the birds and the young. And there's something, I want it all. Greed, just on a very, very small level. Short term, quick buck, petty greed, petty things. And verse 8, this not refusing to build a parapet on the roof of your house. Just people rejecting their basic responsibilities towards themselves and to their neighbors. Those little carelessness, those little shortcuts, those bodged jobs that don't seem to be that important. It could cost somebody their life. As we go on there, verse 9 through to 10, these kind of trying to maximize, you know, you've got a vineyard, the vineyard's a vineyard, and they're trying to sow corn in a vineyard or vines in a cornfield. You know, can't the cornfield be a cornfield and the vineyard be a vineyard? They're trying to just over-maximize, too clever by half. They're adulterating the purity of these things and merging and muddying the waters. And at the end there, in verse 12, these tassels on the garment. These tassels, you know, they represent, don't they? They represent... the commandments, and they were to be worn on the outside of the garments. So you could see that I am the Lord and I have a responsibility to keep God's law. And everybody else can see as well that you are the Lord's and you're committed to keeping God's law. And here, these people who won't put the tassels on their garment, they're saying, I don't want people to know. I don't even want to remember. I just want to turn my eyes away. I just want to be another kind of person for us. I want to forget that I belong to God and that he is my Lord. Little things, this is all the petty godlessness, and that we, truthfully, we've talked about the big things, law and wars and murder. Thankfully, most of us don't have to deal with that very much. This stuff, we deal with it all the time. We deal with it all the time. It's not big ticket items. It's the low-level sinfulness. It may not warrant a capital punishment. It's not a capital offense. These things are not a capital offense. They're regulations, if I can put it like that. But they're the values that express your character. And values really matter. Whether you're neighborly, that matters. Whether you're self-respecting, that matters. Whether you have some capacity to restrain yourself, whether you're conscientious, whether you care, whether you've got some self-discipline, whether you have national pride, whether you care about who you are, these things, these matter. People are known by their character, aren't they? If I was to say to you, this is in no particular order, and I haven't picked on anybody in particular, okay, but if I say to you the word Italian, maybe something comes to your mind. If I say to you Polish, maybe something comes to your mind. If I say to you American, perhaps some character comes to your mind. If I say Chinese, something perhaps comes to your mind. What if I say English? What's the character? What are the values? What's at the heartbeat of a group of people? What are we about? You could think about, like, if I say Buddhists, if certain things perhaps will come to your mind. If I say Hindus, perhaps something will come to your mind. What should come to mind? What comes to mind? We say Christian. What does Christian mean? What are the values? What's the character of Christian people? And it's often the little things. It's often not our big doctrinal statements. It's the little things. It's how they work out in our private lives, in our personal lives, the mundane things. You think of Jesus when he preaches on the Ten Commandments. When Jesus preaches on the Ten Commandments in the Sermon on the Mount, what does he end up talking about? He talks about lust. That's a kind of like an inward attitude of the heart, isn't he? Isn't it? He talks about intolerance, the way that people break up their relationships, their marriage relationships so easily, almost like a drop of a hat. They don't persevere, don't see it through. You know, it's like so intolerant of each other. How boastful people can be. The hatred that exists between ordinary people on the street and the self-righteousness that just affects the kind of religious life of the country. And God sees what's in secret. God sees the secret things. Nobody is going to prosecute you for not picking up your neighbor's wallet. It's not going to happen. But how many of you have had your keys handed in at the police station or had your wallet handed back? How good does that make you feel? It makes you just want to give a reward or something. Just thank the Lord, don't you? That these values are still in place. When you break down on the side of the road and people drive past, and it's, you know, anybody been splashed with one of those big puddles walking down? The little things, the manners. And these things shape people's whole attitude towards you. In Tokyo Metropolitan Police, this is one example I have, the Lost and Found Center in 2002. This is amazing. 2002, people found and brought to the Tokyo Center $23 million in cash were handed in. That's quite impressive, isn't it? And 72% of it was returned to its owners. That is a sign of something, isn't it? Of a kind of commitment to each other. When you have something like that, that contributes to your whole sense of well-being, doesn't it? It makes you feel good about who you are. You know, we can have our big doctrinal statements. We can have the Ten Commandments written on the wall of the church. But in the end, it's how it works out in practice, even down to the daily details of our lives. That People see this stuff. People see. And that's what makes an impression. The little stuffs matter. So why? Why do we sometimes stand aloof from our neighbors? Why do we look the other way? Why do we want to be something we're not? Why? What's the greed all about? Why do we can't be satisfied with one? Why do we have to have two? Why do we duck our duties? Why do we try and find these shortcuts or try and conceal who we are? Have you ever done that? Have you ever tried to conceal who you are? Why do we do these things? It's sin, isn't it? Sin is at work in our lives. And we tolerate it at this low level, don't we? We have a sort of a level of tolerance for it, if you like. But it's just as much the flesh and the world and the devil as murder and all the other sort of things. It's the same problem in miniature. And it tells us something about who we are and how needy we are as a people. Sin works through our thoughts. We have a thought and we are followed by a feeling, and then suddenly we take those feelings as our guides. We feel angry about something. We feel perfectly justified to insult somebody and we feel fine. But it's sin, isn't it? It's sin. We think, oh, it's not my problem. We feel self-justified. But it's sin. And we get quite happy with this. We become quite happy with this kind of level. But this passage tells me God is not happy with these things. He doesn't accept them. He doesn't. Because God hates sin. God hates sin. Feels good? Do it. But what if it harms your neighbor? That's their problem. It's sin. Without realizing it, we're losing a great battle. We're losing a great battle. Little by little, drop by drop. A lot of people get quite nostalgic about the war years. They look back and see a time when people supported one another and they worked together. There's a sense of common cause. But the truth is, it wasn't just a survival. There were certain values that when you're under pressure come into the fore. What would happen now? What are the values now? How would things go now? You have to ask the question. So here, this passage reminds us that we need to train our minds, train our thoughts to focus our attention on God and what pleases Him, even in the little things, even in the little things. When the wind and wave comes, when your house is built on the sand, everything gets washed away. Everything gets washed away. And what's Moses doing here? Moses is saying these things out loud. I wonder how foolish he felt talking about a bird's nest to hundreds and thousands of soldiers about to cross the river into Canaan. Did he feel that it was kind of a small matter? He was moved by the Lord to say these things. These statements are being made publicly so everybody can hear. So everybody knows. So they will look at each other and they'll see, how do you conduct yourself in these matters? Realizing the other person knows that these things are expected of each other. Building accountable structures so that people will commit themselves to living, even in their private lives, in a way that honors God. Think of what Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 9. He talks about various laws. He pulls up some of these little laws coming out of places like this. Here's one of them, for example. It says, it's written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle an ox when it treads out the grain. But do you remember what he goes on to say afterwards? It's only a little thing, isn't it? Whether the ox does get its food while it's treading out or afterwards. But God has shown an interest in that point. He says, is it for oxen that God is concerned? Does he not certainly speak for your sake? It was written for our sake because the plowman should plow in hope, the thresher should thresh in hope of sharing in the crop. If we've sown spiritually amongst you, is it too much that we reap material things from you? In the other words, it starts off with a little thing like whether you're going to give the ox its food while it's working. But the big picture, as it blows up, are you going to pay somebody who's done some work for you? Is a person okay to get their reward for their labors? It actually has an implication for all of us. Because there are principles. There are principles at work here. The ox in the ditch and the mother bird and the woman in the man's clothes and the unprotected roof and the cotton and the wool shirt, the tasseled garments, all these things have wider implications. Mark chapter 2 verses 21. No one sews a piece of unshrunk cloth on an old garment. If he does, the patch tears away from it, the new from the old, the worst tear is made. What's he doing? Is he giving a lesson in sewing? Little things have big implications. Lastly, I'm going to focus on one thing out of all these things. I'm going to focus on this issue of cross-dressing, because when I read through it, that was actually the thing that jumped out at me. Partly it jumped out at me because I told you that somebody I know who runs a gents hairdresser had a family coming in. They had a little girl who's dressing as a little boy and is calling themselves by a boy's name. And this, I think the child is 7. And came in for a boy's haircut and wanted to be treated as a boy and all the rest of it. And he, as a Christian, found himself in a very sort of conflicted place about the situation. And there are some things, I think, in this passage here that are broadly, very widely accepted. Broadly, most people accept that you should look out for your neighbor and push somebody's car if it breaks down in the road. Most people broadly accept that you've got to look after the environment. If you completely ruin the environment, the future, there'll be nothing there for us in the future. Most people think that sort of thing, that health and safety is reasonably sensible. You put a parapet around the roof. There's some sense and wisdom into those sort of things, that a person should be free to express their religious faith in public and be open, and that seems a sensible thing to do. But this issue of cross-dressing, this has become quite an issue of late, hasn't it? And people quite understandably say, well, what's the harm in this? It's just dressing up at one end of it and playfulness at one end of it. But I think that I want to say something about it. It's here in verse 5. In verse 5, isn't it? A woman shall not wear a man's garment, nor shall a man put on a woman's cloak, for whoever does these things is an abomination to the Lord your God. It's very strong words. Because I think it's about identity. Gender-specific clothing is universal. Everywhere you go in the world, you'll see people, men and women, differentiating themselves in the way that they dress, expressing something of their masculinity or the femininity according to dress. I was trying to think of one society anywhere in the world that doesn't do this, and the only thing I could think of was Mao's China, when almost everybody had to wear those green jumpsuit things. But even then, I think women found a way of still having a sort of a womanliness about them, and men had a way of a masculinity about them. And there's something there, there's something inherent in people that just gets expressed. But the truth is that men's and women's fashion has changed enormously and is different all the way around the world. You can't just say, this is what men's clothes look like and this is what women's clothes look like, because there's some parts of the world where men wear what look like dresses down to their feet. There's places where women wear trousers, and that's fine too. That's not the issue, is it? It's culturally specific. But the point is, genders exist in the world. And the cultural aspects of gender change. What is seen as masculine, what is seen as feminine, change from culture to culture through different periods of history. There is no one set thing. But one thing it doesn't change, and that's our fundamental biology. You're a man or you're a woman. And that just doesn't change. And the ambiguity and the questions that people have about what is masculine, what is feminine, and people in the fashion industry, they're constantly exploring this in the way that they design clothes for men and for women and so on and so forth. That this questioning and the ambiguity that surrounds this is because of this fluidity and because there is a world full of difference and change. But nature remains. The underlying nature remains. And no matter how much we interfere with nature or abuse nature, it has this remarkable resilience, even if you go through biological changes. I think in the end, even if you make all those steps, fundamentally, you remain what you always were, what you were born. Nature remains. And that's by design. That is by design. And I don't believe that any man can truly appropriate what God has given women. And I don't believe that any woman can truly appropriate what God has given men. Men and women have their gifts from God. And to try and take from the other or possess from the other what is not yours, vice versa, is to resist God. Now, is it an important question to ask, what is female? What is male? How should men be? What's masculine? What's feminine? Is that a good question to ask? I would say yes, it is. Because all the cultures of the world have their own view of what is masculine. And some of them are so perverse and distorted that you want to cry out to God and say, Lord, please show me what a man should be, what a woman should be. Well, that's a good question to ask. And keep conforming to our Maker and be transformed by the word of our Maker. Because honestly, some of the impressions you get from the world of masculinity and femininity are abominable. But to betray your sex, to try and take what's not yours, to reject God's gift, is to offend God. It's to set out to offend God. Now, do people have strong desires? Are feelings strong and passionate? Yes, they are. We have impulses, we have attractions, and our emotions are compelling. Our desires are compelling. And the trouble is that these feelings, because they proceed from our hearts, they proceed from the inside of us, as it were, although often they have been stimulated by things that have come from the outside, and they can be accelerated by things that come from the outside. They feel natural. Because they come from our hearts. And because they feel natural, we give them an authority. Because we say, this is how I feel. And so it's normal. But the truth is, and if you look at the next section, chapter 22, we've looked at these various laws. You look at verse 13 onwards. The idea that cross-dressing or whatever like that is the only subject for concern expressed about human sexuality is a nonsense. Human sexuality is profoundly affected by the fall in all its shape and forms. It's not just men dressing as women. It's the way men act towards women, promiscuity. There are so many causes for concern in the way human beings express themselves sexually that is sinful. But... our biology remains as a testimony of the Creator's intention for who we're to be and how we're to live. And the Scripture agrees. And the Scriptures testify to these things. So, if you seek fulfillment by gratifying your sinful nature, you're warring with the Spirit. You're warring with the Spirit. The question is, whether if you deny or seek to deny a person's fulfillment, is this just a false errand to try and deny people personal fulfillment? And I think we have to ask this one question. We're coming towards the end. The question is this: is sexual gratification essential? Must we gratify our sexual desires? This is the question. And to answer that question, we have to look at Jesus. Jesus, the unmarried man. Is Jesus a complete man? Is Jesus complete? He's complete. Entirely complete. So here is a complete man who does not give way to his sexual appetites and passions, and yet is satisfied and complete. And people, when they see Jesus, this content, satisfied, an unmarried man, raise all sorts of somewhat blasphemous, incredulous questions about his sexuality. That, you know, the internet is awash with rumors about, was Jesus gay, or was he really married to Mary Magdalene, and all this kind of nonsense, because people are incredulous at the idea that a person could be complete as he is complete. And in truth, what's happening, those rumors and those things that are said, are people seeking to justify their own lusts. They want to justify and prove their own lusts by prescribing them as if they were normal. Or they just say, Jesus isn't normal. Jesus isn't normal. Jesus is asexual. He doesn't have these passions and desires. What do we know about Jesus' sexual passions and desires? We don't know anything. We don't know anything. But if Jesus, we know that he is a perfect man, a complete man, and all those capacities are there, perfectly adjusted. They are there. And yet he submits it all to God. The day by day little things of his personal sexuality, he submits it to God. And he doesn't try to be something he's not. And if Jesus isn't normal, if he is incomplete, and the scriptures, what they say of him, is not so, then we are lost and have no savior at all. And there is no hope in this world. Eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. Jesus said something about sexuality. We have something. Matthew chapter 10, verse 7. A man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. Men and women are compatible. They are compatible. A little various law, but with big implications. Big implications. It's not a small thing to submit to God, is it? It's a great and glorious thing to submit to God. Your daily life, the little things, the secret things, your personal passions and desires, your hopes and dreams, the appetites that work on the inside, the desire for more, all those sort of things. And daily, daily, bring yourself to him. Lord, make me more like Jesus. Make me more like him. We've got a communion service now, and Fiona, you're going to help me, aren't you, to lead the service. And